All right. Well, welcome back from the coffee break. We're again, we're here with Pat and Brian, and we're we've been talking about science fiction, you know, kind of, you know, some of the early stuff, but not to, I guess I'm literally hand waving it, but not to dismiss it. But Brian was saying that science fiction somewhat changed around the 70s, became a bit more modern, I guess, if that could be. I guess science fiction is always modern in a way, but more modern feeling. So what do you mean by that, Brian, exactly?
Yeah, you and Pat both mentioned that the style became more modern, and it did. A lot of it was because the, as you mentioned, the science behind what the planets really were, it became known. And so this was taken up by the science fiction writers. As I mentioned, you know, there was the Cold War and the threat of nuclear Armageddon. Well, back in the late 60s, early 70s, hello, pussycat. There were more threats. There was a book called The Population Bomb, which said...
Wait, is that a killer athi or Kiznin you got there biting the...
This is a... jeez. You know, Jeremy, did you know I was going to tell you that one of the characters on the new Star Trek cartoon, Lower Decks, is a Kazin, but she's not. I was gonna lie to you.
Okay.
Their race is related to the Kazin.
Yeah.
And I wanted to tell you that's what this is, right here, Trudy here, but I forgot the name of that race. Jeremy, I'm doing a bad job.
Well, then you just have to call her your Lord and Master.
That's true. It's true. She calls little Trudy here calls the shots around the house here.
Oh, of course.
But sorry, Brian, I interrupted your train of thought,
okay.
as we do here sometimes.
Yes, well, you know, if the cats are the most important thing. That's true. It's the book called The Population Bomb. It said that in the 70s, there's going to be such a huge population on Earth that there are going to be mass famines as by the middle of the decade. And hundreds of millions are going to die. Guaranteed. And then... a group called the Club of Rome published a little book that said that we're running out of resources and we're all going to die by the year 2100. Like, you know, 90%.
Well, I would probably die by 2100.
Yeah. But, you know, if the planet was going to run out of resources and there's nothing we can do about it. And so all of you regular people should stop trying to be rich like us rich people. And it was a mathematical model that was published, and people ran it, and they're going, this is, I'll try to use a polite word, nonsense, because it's all based on differential equations. And if you remember your differential equations, gentlemen, you change your initial conditions, you can vastly change the result. And
right. This
book chose initial conditions that were, how shall I put this politely, incorrect, total nutter. They assumed that all natural resources had been discovered by the 1930s, 1932 or 34, if I'm recalling correctly, and that none had been discovered since that time. And people going, no, that's idiotic. And so not only that, but they used it's an obscure specialist language called Dynamo, which was known to the scientific community as a flaky way to solve differential equations. But anyway, so after a few years, or the scientists decided, it's our model was premature. But a few years after that, back in the 80s, they retracted their retraction. So there's no record of them ever retracting it originally, except in the minds of old people like me. Anyway, these doom and gloomers inspired people like Jerry Purnell, Larry Niven, a number of other people. So instead of having planetary colonies, they moved to the asteroids, because that's where the mining for resources was going to happen. So
everything in space is cheaper if you don't need the delta V to get
apparently
off out of the gravity well.
Asteroids
are fantastic,
and they said that any details are trivial minor engineering things. We either have the tech, or we'll get it real quick, guaranteed. Yeah,
sure.
And you know, I've got a number of books here about that, about the case for Mars, entering space, where the winds sleep, which is about colonies on the moon. Harry Stein was big. He wrote things like the Third Industrial Revolution, which was space-based, and it would pay for itself. No problem. Trust them. A lot of people like myself did and couldn't understand why it was never done, and they would put the boots to NASA. Like Jerry Purnell was a real booster, like rapidly, and he wrote a number of essays about a number of issues like mining space on the moon, and especially in the asteroids, and there was no danger of running out of resources.
Well, what were they mining at the asteroids?
Iron,
copper.
Well, nobody was really knew what was in the asteroids. They were pretty sure there was iron.
Okay.
But as far as anything else, they weren't quite sure. But trust them; it'll pay for itself.
You know what I always think is funny is it's like. All right, I just thought it was funny. I was watching this this show of Vikings, right? And the guy, Ragnar, he comes back with all this gold and treasure into this tiny, you know, small town. You know, let's just say 20,000 people live there. He's like, I'm so rich. I'm giving this stuff away. I'm like, it seems to me you've just inflated the currency terribly. So it's like if, you know, if you're mining diamonds in space, all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden De Beers is not too rich anymore, and nobody, all of a sudden it's not that cool.
Yeah,
I don't know.
But they assumed commercial fusion reactors by the 1990s at the latest.
That'd be nice.
We missed that.
Yeah,
a bit.
Yeah, and they would have efficient spaceships because of nuclear power somehow magically. But just listen to them and life will be good. And it turns out, anyway, there are a lot of science fiction stories. They were all very libertarian. So you got the libertarian element moving into space. And these were the major science fiction authors that got the big press and the big book runs. So they were very influential. And that's where you get the independent belter theme, or meme, if you will. Because that's where the independent people, the free thinkers, the freedom lovers is what head out would be to the colonies, and Earth would stagnate into a totalitarian state.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, you even see that in, you know, like the Expanse. I keep referring back to that, but you even see that in the Expanse to some extent. You know, maybe Mars is, you know, it's like Mars is more independent, and then the Belters are just do whatever you want.
The problem is, a lot of these minor engineering details that Purnell and Niven spoke about were not so trivial. It turned out they were showstoppers. We didn't.
Yeah, it's hard to get off.
Oh, and the other big thing was because that was the time of the energy crisis in the 70s. Of course, in the 80s, there was the oil glut. But in the 70s, and that's where people started talking about having huge arrays of solar power orbiting the Earth, beaming the power down via microwaves. And that was part of the rationale for having mining on the moon, because you need the resources is to build these things. And it's too expensive to boost it from Earth. So you'd mine the moon, send it to Earth orbit, and they would build these huge structures.
That all sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, but it turns out, well, not if you trusted those writers. It would pay for itself. But the problem is that the energy crisis forced people to think about how to make better solar panels that would work well on Earth, more efficient lighting, LEDs.
That would last for 10 years, guaranteed.
Yeah. In the vacuum and hard radiation of space, you'd think they'd last longer?
Jeremy, did you know you could buy LED bulbs that will last 10 years? GE only sells them in Dubai.
That's ridiculous,
isn't it? Yeah. I was mad. There's a big Clive has a YouTube video taking them apart. They just have more LEDs that they underdrive them.
Okay, that seems pretty good. LEDs are fantastic, but they're not as good as advertised, unfortunately. Anyway,
they're cheap, good enough that our power requirements did not take off, even though we've got a planetary population that, according to the doomsayers in the 60s and 70s, we should have had a societal collapse as due to famines.
You know, I was reading something about the Chinese are having a bit of a population like the other way. And what they were saying is basically like back in the day, the person, I guess this was inspired by a Dutch guy. And then the people that modeled it for China, the guy was a rocket scientist or something. They're like, well, you're a rocket scientist, so you can go ahead and use these equations to calculate the population of China, and yada, yada, yada. Didn't work out quite how they planned.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that leads back to the problems with things like psychohistory. I mean, yeah. We can't, people have problems post-dicting, that is, explaining what happened, much less predicting.
Well, I think it's important here to think about, like from our perspective, you know, it's like, oh, well, we're, you know, 2024, we know what we're doing now, we're not so naive. But I think about, you know, one thing on your list here is you talked about The Martian and how this is considered such, you know, good hard science fiction and something this guy could have done, yada, yada, yada. But according to you, there's some stuff, at least one major problem with that.
The problem with Mars is, until the 70s, people assumed it was like a desert. Fine, it got colder and, you know, drier than we ever dreamed of, but still you could live there. Turns out not really, because of perchlorates. This is
what are perchlorates?
A series of chemical compounds, and they're quite nasty. Like, it's like living in a toxic waste dump, as it turns out.
So is it like Venus light?
And you got between 0.5% and 1% in the soil. And this is toxic level for humans. It basically affects the pituitary gland and other systems. It also screws up plants, which means you probably couldn't grow much. Hmm. Now, the author was apparently asked about this shortly after his book was published. And he sort of hand waved away, well, you know, you can just wash the perchlorates out of the soil. Turns out that's not entirely correct. People are coming up with enzymes that they think will probably work, maybe. But the problem with The Martian, he hand waved the problems away, which is fine. It's a lovely book. I love it. I have it. Read it several times. But the perchlorate issue makes Mars a toxic waste dump. That's just the way it is. Because don't forget, this stuff isn't just in the soil. It goes into the atmosphere and you get planet-wide dust storms. And the dust is poison. You just can't get away from that.
So that ruins, it doesn't ruin the book. It was still, I mean, I only watched the movie and I thought it was great. But let's just say it ruins, if you really thought about it, that ruins things that ruins that book from a pure science standpoint. But, The big question one has to ask is, well, you know, people want to make a society on Mars, you know, especially somebody like Elon Musk talks about it, yada, yada, yada. Is this totally unrealistic? Is this?
Yes.
Are people just fooling themselves?
As in a word.
Well, that's a little sad.
Yeah. I grew up believing this stuff, Jeremy. You know, this was reality that was just beyond the horizon, if only we dared. And it's crushing to me personally to find out that it's you can't. It's not that it's impossible, but it'd be really difficult, and there's no reason for it. Because as far as we know, Mars has nothing worth getting, other than knowledge. And knowledge is important, and I'm all for scientific planned research that should go out and out and out and out. That's must be done.
Well,
Elon Musk saying that we will colonize Mars ain't going to happen.
Well, I wonder why are we skipping the moon? But that's another question. But I think that's why
we're due for a new moon race.
Yeah, it's the politics of space travel. Mars, I mentioned earlier that you get these memes and it grabs hold of people. And the people making the decisions grew up in my era, where Mars was a place to go to. It was a place of magic and mystery. And it was a place that you could go to because it was just a desert. When Mars and Venus became or were known to be uninhabitable, people came up with the idea of terraforming them, changing the entire planet to make them habitable for us. So you had these grand schemes, crashing icebergs, which you would mine from Saturn because, hey, it's cheap, right? And crashing them into Mars. Mars could be, it could live again. Venus, hey, no problem. You seed the atmosphere with algae and it will gradually precipitate out all the bad stuff and soak up all that nasty CO2, and Venus would become habitable. Now, what would happen to the sulfuric acid? That gets sort of hand-waved away. No problem. Trust us, we'll figure it out. And no, because stuff is complicated, and it's a lot more complicated than anyone ever feared. Space is more difficult. The dust on the moon, you know, as with lunar calling. The problem is the regolith, you can't even call it dirt. It comes in big stones down to very fine dust. It's all like shards of sharp glass, razor blades. They found this out with Apollo. It's during the Apollo landings. And it's basically, if you want to know what it's like, live in a cave where they've mined coal and you've got coal dust all around and you've got to survive in that. That would be life on the moon or Mars.
All right, Brian. So you've, it's a lot of doom and gloom here, but I feel like somebody who's a science fiction fan, like Pat and I and yourself, part of the reason it's so appealing is because you're like, well, maybe like in my lifetime, maybe we'll be able to do some of this stuff. There's like this hope that like this will be something interesting in space that I might see.
Yep.
Is there any hope for us, or is it just might as well?
Yes, there's hope, but it's not going to be large colonies. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned about hope. Back in the 50s and early 60s, there was advertisements flogging space as being just around the corner. It's called
another science fiction.
And I always wondered why all those lovely, fabulous ads that I saw as a kid growing up, what happened to them? Because according to here, I mean, you're going to be landing on the moon. It just takes a little bit of this, a little bit of that. There were high efficiency ion drives that were working in the lab. All we had to do was fire them into space and you could power rocket ships to explore Mars and Venus. No problem. And then they vanished like that. The problem, as it turns out, the companies doing these ads were the military space complex. And it was to encourage young engineers, almost exclusively male, to get and join their team. And once they got their staffing levels up, they didn't need anymore, so they stopped their advertising. Space is hard.
Super duper hard. Because I thought it'd be awesome to be, I'm an engineer now. Probably, because of that.
This is going to happen in the 60s, man.
Yeah, let's say a rocket landing vertically. But look, you know what? I remember in high school, somebody you're saying, oh, well, you know, it's thinking that the rockets landed like they do today, like Elon Musk's rockets, like the SpaceX rockets land. And her, you know, she got mocked for this. And I remember seeing, you know, I saw in Popular Science like a month or two, I'm like, well, look, they are working in this. And now it's like a thing. It's like, you know, maybe not everything in science fiction can be done, but you know, life there's does a, imitate it. Life tries to.
A spaceship, I think, called the DCX. They built it, privately built. They never, achieved orbit. It was a single stage to orbit concept. And they showed it going up, hovering, going over, and coming down. Proven technology. It was bought by one of the armed forces, and they basically improved it into oblivion.
What year, roughly, was this?
80s.
I mean, 80s, okay.
I know because to raise money, they would sell books and VCR tapes. Things were on VCR in those days. And I bought both the book, or it's a couple of books, and a copy of their VHS tape. And my wife and I just both watched this going, this is fabulous. This is the way forward. And it never was.
I wish, you know, you see the first time those three rockets come down, and I wish I was there. I wish I went to that, because I don't live that far away from it. Mm. And that's just a historical moment, and just something that you watch it, and it's like, if I saw that 20 years ago and it, I was like, this is cheesy science fiction. It's not even like done well, but it's like actually happening. It's like, wow.
Well, I remember it was when the space shuttle first went up and came down. That had a huge impact, because I was in a job where I had to fly around a bit. After the first space shuttle came down, and it came down, I mean, it smooth, perfect landing. Every airline pilot tried to emulate that.
Oh, man.
There were, for at least a year, there were no bumpy landings.
I don't know. They wanted
to duplicate what the space shuttle did.
Well, I don't know. After what, 1980, when did Top Gun come out? After that, I think they tried to like land on the carrier each time.
Yeah.
there's some talented pilots out there, obviously. You know, you pilots that are listening, I'm sure you're, you know, feel free to call in on SpeakPipe and let us know your thoughts.
Now, if you are interested in real spacecraft, I strongly recommend it. If you're a tech guy, How Apollo Got to the Moon. This is about a real spacecraft. You know, okay. Apollo. It had never been done. And this goes this into, by, is it, I mean, you know, it's a fairly thick book.
Yeah.
It is very technical. I loved it. Because how do you navigate? You learn details, and they were horrifying.
That does seem horrifying.
They had the lunar excursion module and the command module, and then they had to mate.
Right.
And they talked about going through the airlock. It wasn't an airlock. It was a latch. And they had to take the latch off, go inside, put the latch back on. It wasn't an airlock. It was just...
Sounds pretty claustrophobic.
And it just... The people said, sure, I'll do that. Not a problem. As much as I would love to go into space, I would never do stuff like that. It's just amazing. But how do you navigate? This book tells you how they went about it. It's just a fabulous book for anybody who's interested in real space.
Well, I think, you know, we're getting maybe towards the end of the podcast. I think one thing we might, before we end it, I think one thing it would be cool to end it on is maybe ask you, Brian, why haven't we been back to the moon? And what's your prediction for that in that space?
Jeremy, he told us why we haven't been back to the moon.
It's expensive.
Oh. Yeah, then there's nothing there.
Okay. I thought politics is what he said.
That's the politics of it. Then you get into people say, oh, if the money spent should be spent on Earth. Well,
that's fair.
Every penny is spent on Earth. Well, where's the payback? There's people starving in the streets. Well, you make life better by going out and exploring and trying new things.
Brian, I am going up in that Apollo capsule module, and I am taking a briefcase full of cash to spend up on the moon, and nobody's going to stop me.
He's just making it rain slowly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it'll fall. It'll be amazing. It'll fly so high.
He'll make it rain for so
those $100 bills, and they would fall so slowly. It'll be
magic. I would like to see the next person on the moon make it rain on space. That would be, and just slowly, he'd make it rain for minutes because the dollar bills would just.
You might be able to throw them hard enough that they never come back.
Yeah, send it into. I was going to say send it into orbit, but that's not.
There's realistic. Actually been short stories about that very thing, where people. One of the issues, if you fire a gun on the moon, level with the horizon, that bullet's going to keep going. And if you hit the right valleys and the gaps in between the peaks, it'll just keep going around and around and around, and you can hit yourself in the back of the head.
Yeah, because there's no friction to, like, you know.
Exactly.
Or very little, I guess.
Oh, and I just want to mention that one resource, NASA has a gazillion books on all sorts of topics. And one of the best things NASA has ever done, and they've got things on the minutest things, like their X-15 program, the next best thing to a spaceship that was done prior to the space shuttle. The most successful research project in the history of the world. Really? I'm a big fan of the X-15. It's got things on how to build, or the history of building spacesuits. Like back in the days of early science fiction, they thought it would be simple. Like, here's a shot, classic spacesuit from the era. Big floppy overalls. And hey, presto, no problem. Well, no. Big, huge freaking problem. And it's really hard to do it right. And people just sort of hand-waved it away. Oh, you know, just use the Apollo spacesuits. Well, those were barely adequate. You got to get something better.
I remember NASA has written, thinking that a wetsuit style pressure suit would work. And it would, except they figured out, I don't know. If you put your wetsuit on and it has a wrinkle in it, you're going to be injured, you know, from the vacuum of space. Yeah. You're going to be, the pressure of the elasticity. I just saw the face Jeremy was making, so I figured I should explain. The elasticity holds you in. It's that replaces the pressure. But if there's a fold, the pressure's not even and things get.
Yeah. Well, there was a thing that was talked in this one book I mentioned earlier, is where the winds sleep. The guy said, you can get around the spacesuit issue by having a skin suit, because your skin is airtight, right? And all you need to do is to seal around the neck. And so you got this flexible suit. Hey, presto, you're fine. Problem solved. Well, I actually wrote NASA back in the 70s and said, whatever happened to this research? And they came back and said, it didn't really work because it's not very flexible. And under vacuum conditions, the materials degrade.
And I mean, you couldn't show it on TV either. That would be immodest.
A lot of the covers for the more lurid science fiction novels was buxom young ladies in skin tight latex space suits.
Because of science.
It's because it had a helmet on, but it exposed. I mean, there was nothing left to the imagination.
Right.
I've always enjoyed those covers. But from a technical point of view, they always struck me as being silly. There's one I forgot to bring down where there's a guy wearing a big bubble helmet, as they all did back in the day, air tanks, and he's in a t-shirt. And he's on Pluto.
Just a t-shirt?
Yeah.
It's not that cold. Pluto.
Yeah. Now, the story was better than the cover, as they often are. But, you know, they had these insane covers.
Sometimes they're probably worse. I don't know if you guys see Flash Gordon in Flash in 1979 or so?
Yes.
I just remember seeing that, and they had the Queen theme song at the beginning, and like they were flipping through the comic book. I'm like,
that was Flash Gordon.
Okay.
Yeah, that's Flash Gordon.
This movie is going to be awesome, but that was by far the best part of the movie.
I rewatched that movie last year for the first time in decades. I was bored. I'm going, is this as bad as I remembered?
It's pretty bad.
It was fun. It was campy, silly fun, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I think I enjoyed it more the second time around. Because there are a lot of, you know, big name actors there that weren't big names yet. And it was just so over the top silly.
It worked. It was pretty silly. Yeah. But, you know, I still love that theme song in the,
oh, yeah,
the opening credits.
Except there's not much to it.
Yeah, it's a miracle.
Done by Queen.
I know. Yeah, they seems like they went through their little bit of a sellout is an ugly word, but they were, you know, they did the theme song for that, and then the one for Highlander too.
Yes. We are masters of the universe. Yes.
Yeah.
And written specifically for the movies, not like they were just licensed or something. It was,
speaking of movies, if you like, this is another great book. I don't know if it's in print anymore. The Spaceship Handbook. It's got real world and fictional spaceships, and it goes into some detail.
Oh, that's pretty. And you have the Spaceship Handbook you're holding up there.
But the end of it, the appendix, has a number of detailed calculations on how spaceships work.
Oh, that's awesome.
It also has a number of real world things like the U.S. Nuclear rocket program and a thing called Project Pluto. Now, this was the Cold War, the early days of the Cold War. Project Pluto was a nuclear powered airplane. It was a doomsday weapon. And once launched, it could fly for days or weeks. And typically the problem with nuclear rockets is you want to minimize the nuclear stuff coming out. This maximized it.
Oh,
the object was to go to the enemy and fly over their country for days and weeks.
That's pretty messed up. I mean, I guess war is always messed up, but
other words that you probably don't want me to use on the podcast.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
Jeremy doesn't let me use those words on the podcast, Brian.
Yeah.
He says no.
Because he's a good boy. But he'll grow out of it.
Someday.
But anyway, this is a Fowler's book. It has details.
Spaceship Handbook. Yeah, that's pretty neat.
But thank you for letting me come here, because doing the research for this, I had to dig into my library, and I found all sorts of old friends I hadn't seen in ages.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for coming on. It's great to get some insight about this, because it's a question that I was like, I was like, wow, this had to be just devastating for people like Brian and whatever. And,
another book. If you're interested in the why things are so much harder, this is a great book that came out this year.
A City on Mars. Okay.
Yeah.
Zach Wienersmith. I feel like I've.
He does the Saturday morning breakfast cereal comic book or online comic.
That's a fantastic comic.
That is. And he and his wife wrote this. They spent several years researching this because they were space fans. And they started asking the question, well, why aren't we doing this stuff? Why
is
it so hard?
That tells us why.
And they found out why.
Okay. And you can too. So A City on Mars by, Zach Wienersmith? Is that
Kelly and Zach Wienersmith.
Kelly and Zach Wienersmith. All right. All right.
They'd probably be interesting guests too.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't get any kickbacks from them, by the way. They don't even know that I exist.
Well, that being said, Brian,
they do now.
People wanted to find you and your work, you write. I shouldn't be pointing at people accusingly.
Are you pointing at me again?
I don't know. I'm pointing at somebody.
No. He's shaking his finger at me again.
Stop. Where do we find you if we want to see your, obviously, you know what you're talking about as far as science fiction, and you've written some. So where do we find your work?
I have a website, www.briangriner.ca or .com, and it'll go to the actual site. Go to your favorite online bookseller. I sell on all of them, Amazon, Kobo, Apple.
And when you look up Brian Griner, is that correct? Yeah.
Okay. If you want me to flog something, there.
Yeah, we'd love that. Here. Okay, Brian Griner, and it's spelled G-R-E-I-N-E-R.
Yep.
It's Inheritance of Woe. It's a Saga of Bob number 5. And I have read a couple of the Saga of Bob books, and he's quite the fun character. Bit of a...
Okay, Jeremy, you got to tell me, is it Saga or Saga?
Saga or Sega. It's not Sega.
Sega.
It's a Saga of Bob. It's not. It's Saga. The Saga of Bob.
Yeah. The ongoing Saga. Bob is the sort that likes to throw himself into the path of an ongoing train and try and stop it. He gets beaten up a lot, and in this book, he deals with his adult children.
Okay.
Well, yeah, horror sounds... upon horror.
Interesting.
And, if you want something lighter, this is a book of poetry and pictures of my cat.
Oh, haiku cat.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You know, I have to say, I didn't buy it, but I thought about buying that as a gift for somebody for Christmas, and maybe they'll get it next Christmas. It's because yeah. I feel like cat lovers would love that book.
Honestly, I mean, you know, it's basically a picture is with a haiku.
Okay, can you read us
from the point of view from the cat?
Can you read us a sample haiku from
companion cats mutate into overlords, lull staff with purring.
It's pretty good. I think cat people would love that book.
Yes. Yeah. Now. It comes as an ebook or a paperback. The paperback is hideously expensive, I will admit, because that's just the cost of printing. I have zero influence on that.
And it's so, printed in color, it looks like. All color paint. That must drive up the price by 5% at least.
Hmm.
Or actually a factor of 3.
Yeah. Or 300%.
Oh, 300%. Don't get me started on the cost of books. Yeah. Buy the ebook. Or by the paperback, you know, I'm fine with that. I mean, you know, if you're rich. Another thing, talk to your local library. Have them buy it.
That's not a bad idea. Yeah.
Because
that book I was talking about, the Lost in the Taiga book, is about some people that went to Russia in like the 30s or something. And they were basically were there for like the Cold War and didn't know what was going on. I got that from the library because I think it was seriously expensive on Amazon because I'm not sure it's in print anymore. So,
yeah.
Library. This would be a good coffee table book to go along with my other favorite coffee table book from my other favorite guest.
Oh,
Open Hardware.
Open circuits. Yeah.
Mm. It's all up close photography, macro photography.
Oh, yes. I saw that episode. Yeah.
Hardware that's cut into computers, too. Watches. Calculators. It's a really good book for somebody to just randomly pick up at your house and leaf through while you're busy ignoring them.
Yeah.
Well, so what about you, Pat? Where can we find you if we don't want to go to your house and sift through
Jeremy,
your
I'm gonna tell you I want to be in on the author thing. So I'm gonna tell you that if you search for my name on Amazon, Pat Regan, you will find two UFO conspiracy books.
Ooh.
They're not by me. They're by another Pat Regan. But it doesn't matter. I think it's hysterical. I think it's awesome. And I've never read them. I thought about buying them because I thought they'd be fun to have on the bookshelf.
Yeah, that'd be funny. That'd be fun.
Yeah, but go check them out and see if they're... Maybe don't buy them. I don't know. I can't tell you if they're any good. But they've got my name on them. So, nice. And it must be science fiction. I don't know that it's...
I don't know that I trust anything inside the book. I have a number of books like that, yeah.
Yeah.
I love me a good conspiracy.
Yep.
Could be science opinion. Is that a genre?
It's not, maybe.
Maybe it's not true, but it's not. He's not writing it as fiction.
You can't prove
it's
it.
Like,
you can't prove it's wrong.
It's hard
you to can't prove
mega.
It's right, but you can't prove it's wrong.
Yeah. Yep.
So, yeah. Science Jeremy. Opinion. I've just made up a new genre, so...
I'll write the first novel in science opinion.
All right. Well, as for me, you can find me, jeremyscook.com. Also, putting some YouTube videos out under a channel called JCO Audio. So it's going to be like audio focused hacking stuff. So I'm excited about that. So
I saw you turn a little thumb instrument into a MIDI.
Yeah. Actually, weirdly enough, I've got it right here, and it's got a strange, strange tie-in. It's got a cat on the sound hole. So it's a MIDI kalimba with a cat on the sound hole. I don't know why it's got a cat on the sound hole.
Is that what that hole is called?
I think so.
Like, did you make that up, or is that what it is?
I made it up, then I looked it up, and I think that's what it is.
Because, Jeremy, I have a sound hole.
Your mouth, yeah.
I have two sound holes, but we can't talk about the other one, because you don't allow that sort of thing, Jeremy.
Yeah, well, I guess you wouldn't turn that into
MIDI. He really is.
You wouldn't turn that into a MIDI instrument, I would hope.
Well, it depends on how invasive the procedure is, Jeremy.
Elon Musk. Like,
if all you need is a microphone, that's no big deal. I'd participate.
All right. Well,
I'm not soldering anything to it.
No, you don't want to do that. So. Well, Brian, you know, thank you so much for coming on. You know, hopefully, I think that Haiku Cat book looks like a lot of fun. So.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and Pat, of course, always good to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure to talk to me, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to talk to both of you today again.
Indeed.
Do we wave or something, Jeremy? Do we?
Yeah. I guess as we say every time, don't hang up yet until it's... Oh, wait, I gotta actually stop. I gotta stop.
Oh, I'm doing the wrong theme song, Jeremy.
Speaking of countdowns, Pat, I was my son saw this, the final countdown by that band, and they're called Europe. And I told him it was such a good song that they actually named the continent after the band. And he said he didn't think that was true. And I assume he's right.